Hello, and welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main issue. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. First the news, and later in the show we'll bring you a new feature, an end-of-the-month expert panel, looking back, looking forward. Today, the experts will be Brian Bonner, editor of the Kyiv Post, and Inna Bidluska of the International Renaissance Foundation.
They're already heavily armed. There are more Russian tanks there than in Western Europe.
And now I'll give the floor to Mr. Alexander Hook, Principal Deputy Chief Monitor of the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission to Ukraine.
Сьогодні вся країна зрозуміла, яка ціна вашим обіцянкам.
I do know for a fact that Democratic Party operatives went to the Ukrainian embassy to coordinate oppositional research and attacks against our campaign.
Mr. President, I would like to thank you for convening this open debate to discuss the most burning issues.
And now the news. Following a week in which Ukraine suffered its heaviest casualties this year in its war with Russian-backed forces in the Donbas, on the 21st of July, Ukraine's envoy to the United Nations, Volodymyr Yelchenko, sent a letter to the UN Secretary-General and head of the Security Council with a statement for the General Assembly. In it, Ukraine, quote, expresses its strongest protest against the intensification of Russia's hybrid forces, including with the use of tanks, self-propelled artillery, rocket launchers and mortars, unquote, and demands from the Russian Federation, quote, an immediate halt to the armed provocations which are increasing the number of casualties and the destruction of regional infrastructure, unquote. Well, the new U.S. envoy visited Ukraine again and did not mince his words. U.S. Special Representative for Ukraine Negotiations, Kurt Volker, visited Ukraine at the beginning of the week and saw for himself frontline locations. Among the conclusions he shared with the media were that the conflict in the Donbas is not a civil war in Ukraine, as Russia depicts it, but the result of Russian military aggression. That the question of Crimea cannot be separated from that of the Donbas, and that, quote, there are more Russian tanks in there than tanks in Western Europe combined, unquote, and that arming Ukraine with lethal defensive weapons would help it be better prepared to defend itself. And there was a new round of Normandy 4 telephone talks on the Donbas conflict. On the 24th of July, the Normandy 4 leaders of Ukraine, Russia, France and Germany held a new round of talks over the phone in this format, focusing on the settlement of the conflict in the Donbas. According to President Poroshenko's press secretary, the Ukrainian leader urged Russia to stop aggressive actions and arms supplies to the occupied territory and demanded a full ceasefire. According to a joint press release by German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron, following the phone talks, quote, the heads of state and government agreed that the political, humanitarian and economic issues, as well as the security aspects of the Minsk package, should be fully implemented, unquote, that, quote, ceasefire violations must cease immediately, unquote, and necessary measures be taken to prevent damage to civilian infrastructure, quote, to prevent a humanitarian disaster in Donbas, unquote. The importance of withdrawing heavy weapons as well as the secure access for the OSCE special monitoring mission to all parts of Donbas, including the temporarily uncontrolled parts of the Ukrainian-Russian border, should be ensured, as well as the security of the OSCE mission members. This was stressed. Macron and Merkel also emphasized the inadmissibility of any statements undermining Ukraine's territorial integrity, in particular on the creation of the so-called Malorossiya. For his part, Russia's President Putin once again called the Russia-backed war in Donbas an internal Ukrainian conflict, indicating that no change in Moscow's position could be expected. And a Russian military buildup on Ukraine's borders has been noted. The chief of Ukraine's general staff, Viktor Mozhenko, warned that Russia has massed significant strike forces on Ukraine's border. He announced this week that Russia has recently deployed 3 divisions of motorized rifle troops capable of conducting rapid offensive operations. A week ago, while on an official visit to Kyiv, Belarus's President Alexander Lukashenko sought to reassure his Ukrainian hosts that the Belarusian border would, quote, never be a border of war, unquote. But Ukrainian Defense Minister Stepan Poltorak pointed out that the joint Russian-Belarusian military exercises West 2017, scheduled for September 14 to 20th of this year, are giving rise to concern, as up to 13,000 military personnel are expected to take part in the exercise. On the domestic front, the big story of the week was the surprise announcement that President Poroshenko has stripped Georgian ex-president turned Ukrainian politician and reformer Mikhail Saakashvili of Ukrainian citizenship. The two had been political allies, but later fell out after Saakashvili accused Poroshenko of not supporting sufficiently his efforts to combat corruption while governor of the Odessa region. Saakashvili has sought to create his own reformist, opponents say populist, Ukrainian political party, and has been outspoken in his criticism of Poroshenko and his team.
Сьогодні ви, Петре Олексійовичу, переступили межу. Сьогодні вся країна зрозуміла, яка ціна вашим обіцянкам.
Though formal reasons were cited for the decision, namely that Saakashvili had withheld evidence about charges leveled against him by the Georgian authorities, most observers concluded that the move against him was purely political. Kyiv's mayor and ally of President Poroshenko, Vitaly Klitschko, commented that depriving Saakashvili of Ukrainian citizenship would damage the image of Ukraine. And as for the war, during the week, skirmishing and shelling continued along the front line, though at a somewhat lower level of intensity. On the 22nd of July, OSCE patrols were blocked by the pro-Russian forces near the town of Novoazovsk, Donetsk region. Monitors registered an active movement of military vehicles across the Russian-Ukrainian border. On the 21st of July, pro-Russian forces fired at residential areas of Mariinka, Donetsk region, wounding 4 civilians, including 2 children. According to the principal deputy chief monitor of the OSCE special monitoring mission to Ukraine, Alexander Hogue, the number of casualties among civilians since the beginning of 2017 has increased by 50% compared to the same period of last year. Overall, during the last week, 3 Ukrainian soldiers were killed in action and 12 were wounded.
Hello, welcome to a new feature on our show, Hromadske Radio Ukraine Calling. I'm Marta Dachok in Kyiv, and this week we're introducing an expert panel discussion. At the end of every month, we're going to have 2 experts, possibly 3, talk about what's been happening over the past month. In studio with me, I have Brian Bonner, who's an American, and he's the editor-in-chief of Kyiv Post, which is the oldest English-language newspaper in Ukraine.
And the best one.
And the best one. And Ina Pilusky, who is a political analyst, a longtime political commentator, and she's now the executive deputy director of the International Renaissance Foundation, which is the oldest NGO in Ukraine, founded back in 1990 by George Soros. So thank you very much for finding the time to join us. This has been a very hot month, July. Not just the temperature, but the politics and society in Ukraine has been bubbling. There's been all these international high-level visitors. There's been a lot happening in Parliament. There's been an attempt to bring corrupt members of Parliament to justice. The Normandy format has been revived. The war in the East has been revived. Let's try to help our listeners understand what all of this means. Brian, I'd like to start with you. Of all of the things that happened this month, what do you think is the most significant that has really a long-term impact that's going to happen in Ukraine?
We have had an eventful summer. Unfortunately, Parliament broke off and went on a long summer vacation, undeserved, without passing pension reform, without creating the anti-corruption court, without creating an agricultural land market, without doing health care reform, without making progress on privatizing state-owned enterprises. And this is all to the detriment. They're not behaving like leaders. They're not behaving like a nation at war or in crisis. And I think what matters to Ukrainians is the effect this is going to have on the economy, which is already very, you know, still sluggish. You know, we've lost half of our gross domestic product since 2013. We're now crawling back into growth, but I think
we are. Last week we had an expert who said that the economy is growing.
It is 2 to 3%. But after you lose half of your economy, I think it's a stretch to think that Ukrainians are going to be patient with 2 to 3% growth, which means essentially it'll take decades to catch up to where we were back in Yanukovych time. And so the standard of living, there's a lot of frustration out there. It's summer, it doesn't seem like it, but there's a lot of frustration out there. And the effect of a parliament failing to do its job is that we're not going to see the foreign direct investment that Ukraine needs to grow at the rate of 6 to 7 to 8% to get back where it was quickly and to give a better standard of living for people. So I give a big fail to parliament and the political leadership for not only stalling reforms, foot-dragging, but obstructing reforms actively and throwing Ukraine off the IMF program or making delays. And we don't know. Now it looks like it's going to be next year before any installment. Now, Ukraine is not going to financially collapse, but the signal to investors is very bad, and that is the very critical element to reviving Ukraine's economy.
Well, for the high level criticism, let's hear from what's this civil society has been doing. We have an expert here who can tell us perhaps a different picture.
Thank you. Really, what we've been observing, that's mostly from the perspective of the civil society, and we were trying to see what the parliament and the government have been doing, or rather what they have not done, and that was were the things which would affect reforms, including those reforms which the civil society says very significant for Ukraine and for Ukrainians.
Tell us again what the important reforms that civil society is pushing.
From my perspective, the most important ones would be actually the healthcare reform, the anti-corruption reforms, of course, and the anti-corruption court, which needs to be put in place, and also the effective functioning of the new anti-corruption institutions, which is the National Anti-Corruption Bureau. Another reform would be the election reform, which would bring in a new election legislation, bringing in more financial transparency of political parties. This actually, we do have some very modest progress, and the National Agency for Preventing Corruption has started to look into how the political parties report for the assets they have generated for their operation. But we are still way far away from really having a transparent political system with the transparent election system, which would make sure that there's no dirty money in politics, which do affect a lot of what we're having. Then there are a couple of more reforms I really want to mention, because I think they are incredibly significant for the society and for the people. One is decentralization report.
Can we hold off on that? Because let's stay with the anti-corruption, because this is something that both of you talked about. We'll come back to that.
Okay.
In Parliament, there was this attempt to bring corrupt or members of parliament who were allegedly corrupt to justice. And it sort of half happened, half didn't happen. So, I mean, do you not see that there's a push that's happening from different directions and that the fight is still ongoing? Or do you see that it's really just a bleak picture, that it's a fail all around? And again, this is from the legislation. Some of the legislation is in place. Some of it isn't in place.
Well, the fight is still ongoing. But the fact of the matter is, more than 3 years after the revolution, zero people have been convicted of any high-level crime, corruption, murder, anything. And this is by design. There's no new Supreme Court. Everybody knows, every lawyer, every business person knows that the court system here is unable to do its job and to take any case or any trial to adjudication except for political persecution. We have unreformed courts. We have unreformed prosecutors. We have unreformed police, largely. I'm talking the Interior Ministry. I'm talking SBU. I'm talking other law enforcement organs. So as far as the parliament members who have been charged or, you know, suspected of financial corruption, well, good luck trying to get those through the courts, because we still have the same corrupt court system that we had. And we're seeing that the judges aren't doing their job. They're letting people out on bail. again, this raises the question, why does Parliament, more than 3 years after the revolution, still have legal immunity from prosecution and they have to have a majority of the members remove it? We're still far away from what Ukrainians demanded on the revolution, on the justice front.
I only can agree with what Brian is saying. Indeed, this has been a lot of disincentive for the people to produce, to participate effectively and actively when they see that although there is the legislation and there's a lot of anti-corruption norms which should be followed and the instruments, well,
there,
many of them,
some
are,
of them are
here.
There. Yeah.
So again, this is like... We could say speak about the notorious political will. We could speak about the circles of support within the parliament. Or we could speak about the courts. And Brian mentioned the problem with the courts, which we are still having. So the system does resist, and it resists very effectively. There is a huge push from the international community, and we do appreciate that a lot. There is also a huge push from the civil society, and indeed a very significant demand for the anti-corruption progress. But unfortunately, there were quite a few steps last month when the anti-corruption watchdogs themselves were under attack, and that's not over yet. So that's one of the things which I do see as quite a bad sign and something which really needs to be addressed if Ukraine stays on this course which it has declared so firmly.
You touched on international pressures. There's been a lot of international activity happening in Ukraine this past month. Let's talk a little bit about that. Of all the visitors who came, who said the most important thing? What's the takeaway from these visitors who have come, who continue to come?
Well, I think it's been an unprecedented. I don't know about you, Ina, but I can't remember a week where we had the U.S. Secretary of State, the NATO Secretary General, both the European Union leaders and the United Nations Secretary General. And I think they were very, very, very effective. I thought Tillerson's visit was a political masterstroke. He met with the civic society leaders and the reformers in the U.S. ambassador's residence before he met with Poroshenko. Clear signal. He laid it on the line in public to Poroshenko that if he expects investment, he'd better reform. U.S. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg also hit on the cancer of corruption. If you hope to get close to NATO, you got to cure this. This is not just about reforming your military and having a modern military. It's about having a democratic society with institutions. And the European, UN was a little bit soft, but the European Council was very mixed. We had Jean-Claude Juncker's clunker, where he all inexplicably backtracked on a long-standing EU demand for the creation of an independent anti-corruption court. Now, he backtracked, but I mean that kind of mixed signal is not going to help Ukraine get to where it needs to go or where Ukrainians want it to go.
Yeah, I think there was a clarification, actually, on Mr. Juncker's statement, and I think it was very important that the EU actually repeated again and again that it's very firm on anti-corruption in Ukraine should honor its commitments, including the anti-corruption courts. And indeed, we do see the strong voices of people who care about Ukraine, who come here to support the delivery of reform, to bring in international attention and international support. But add conditions to that, and those conditions really help push Ukraine in the right direction. We do talk about this reform sandwich, which is the international community.
That's a great
international
phrase.
Friends of Ukraine pushing from the top, and then the civil society in Ukraine providing this necessary public demand for the reforms, and we see it very important. It works. I wish the government and the parliament actually also did their job more effectively and actively, and both the international community and the society didn't have to have this reform sandwich and the push, but this is what we have now. And also, although we understand that the attention to Ukraine is here for a reason which I would prefer we didn't have. That's the war, and that's a really very serious situation in Ukraine's economy and the situation with the reforms and so on. Still, it's important.
Thank you. That's where I wanted to go to next. The war has heated up again. This month, we saw an escalation of fighting, increasing casualties, and the newly appointed U.S. envoy coming to Ukraine twice. And for me, what was the standout was that he said, this is a hot war. This is not anything other than that. What is the significance of that? I mean, how important is the war? Corruption is one issue, but the war and the international attention to the war, what do you see happening with that?
Well, I think Kurt Volker's appointment is a positive sign for Ukraine. He has a very good reputation and a very good understanding of the situation, but basically he's just talking reality. I also think what's happening in Congress today is going to help, where they're going to codify tougher sanctions against Russia, tie Donald Trump's hands, which in this issue he needs to have to be restrained, because he continues to spout pro-Kremlin and today anti-Ukrainian tweets, which are very disturbing. But I think overall, I think the policy of the United States and the West is clear on Ukraine. However, I still argue that the West is not doing enough. They continue to do business with Russia, continue to do have a lot of trades. Nord Stream 2 is moving ahead. This I cannot understand for the life of me why the EU and the United States, the West collectively, are not taking a tougher stance on Russia, on this war, because the war is probably not going to end until Putin is, you know, forced to make it end, or he sees that the costs of waging war are too high. And I don't know when that point will be reached, but overall, Putin has not shown any change in his strategic, you know, view that Ukraine is not a sovereign state and that he wants to continue to interfere and hobble its development, just like he's doing in Georgia, Moldova, Armenia, Azerbaijan, on and on and on.
So you don't see a shift in American policy here with this envoy and the stronger statements coming out of Volker's?
Well, I'm encouraged that the people around Trump seem to be taking a even tougher line than the Obama administration.
Yeah,
but we still have the wild card known as Donald Trump. And so I don't know what's going to happen. You can pass tougher sanctions laws, but as I understand it, you know, it's back to implementation if Trump wants to actively implement it. I still think we need absolutely a tougher stance from the West, because I don't think Ukraine is going to be able to do this alone.
Ina, I know you focus on civil society, but what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so let me try and look at that from a domestic perspective. And what we've been seeing these couple of weeks or few weeks is that Ukrainian government is trying to see how they actually can be more active in supporting the people in the conflict-affected areas. Obviously, there have been a lot of criticism that the government is not doing enough and the parliament is not doing enough to support the internally displaced persons, to ensure that there is the safe and well-organized regime of the crossing of the contact line, also to ensure that Ukrainians who stay on occupied territories do feel that the state cares about them and the state is there to try and find solutions. And also there is the huge issue of Ukrainians who are being held hostage in the occupied territories and also in the Donbas as well in the Crimea. There has been a lot of I do think there has been a huge effort from the Ukrainian state to try and facilitate the release of hostages and do that. So perhaps the greater involvement from the U.S. and also
a
stronger position in the Normandy format would help move these things forward. So we think this is, quite a clear intention of the Ukrainian government, but we do need international support for that as well.
Let me get you guys to look forward. We're at the end of July. What's going to happen in August? What do you see the big issues coming up over the next
August? Month? Everybody will be on vacation, but I want to go back to...
That's a worrying thing. Like, everybody's on vacation in August, so
it's
you never
trouble.
Know what,
it's
what happens.
Trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I August go back of 2014, that was Ilovaisk. August of 1991, that was the coup. August, we think of it as the sleepy summer month, but...
A lot of strange things happened in August, not only here and in Russia, too, because that was the month of the Kursk and many other tragedies. I want to go back to what Ina said in electoral reform. I've sort of lost faith in this parliament and, frankly, in this president to push through the needed changes that that Ukrainians are demanding. And that goes back to electoral reform. We need a new electoral law. We need a clean, transparent, responsive, representative election law. Let the Ukrainian people choose their next leaders. I think the current incumbents, if there is a new fair election law, are going to be in for a big surprise, because Ukrainians, marvel at their patience as an American, but we also know that if you push Ukrainians too far, they will fight back.
Well, with the elections definitely in the air, of course, we are still a couple of years before the next election. But if you look at all the political debate and all the things which are happening in the parliament, and including all this upsurge in political populism about all the reforms, be it the healthcare reform, be it the pension reform or the land reform, which is effectively stalled and a matter of a huge political manipulations and all the discussions. So you would definitely sense that August is not going to be very quiet, and September is going to be quite a very important month, because a lot of the reforms which have not been launched by the parliament in the last couple of weeks, basically a couple of days when they still operated in mid-July, are being effectively shifted to September, and we hope that the parliament will scoop whatever responsibility it has and go ahead with the healthcare reform and also with the anti-corruption, including the anti-corruption reforms and the anti-corruption court.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing from you guys next month. Let's hope that everybody both has a good vacation and works forward on all the our projects and watching what's going to happen in the world. We've been speaking with Ina Pilewski of the International Renaissance Foundation, Brian Bonner of the Kyiv Post. Tune in next month. Oh, and my name is Marta Dechok for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Ukraine Calling will be back with this feature next month. Thank you very much.
Thanks
for having us.
Yeah, thanks very much.
And now, culture. History of the Future. That's the title of a new book by Yuri Bilak. It was launched this week in a space in Kyiv called Ostanya Barrikada that we featured in an earlier show. It's a photo album about Ukraine from the Euromaidan through the war in Donbass. And over the weekend, there's an event called Connect Ukraine Festival happening at Kyiv's Art Factory platform. 2,000 visionaries, innovators, and technology leaders from all over the world are coming to Kyiv to share their ideas. And now for music. Well, some new sounds, soundtracks, appeared on SoundCloud this week by a Ukrainian Crimean Tatar project called Artu Ya, or Ramzik and Remzik. All we know about them is that they are two musicians who are playing music that's nothing like they've played before. But the music has clear Crimean Tatar melodies and flavors. Hromadske Radio leader Andriy Kulikov tried to interview them, but at last Ramzik and Remzik insisted that they want to remain incognito. But they graciously agreed to let us play one of their songs on Ukraine Calling. Have a listen to Kwati, a title which is tricky to translate, but it means something like tough, harsh. Let us know what you think.
Ит, tape de but, tape la vie, mais tu te mets sur it, écoute, et chute.
And looking forward, next week we'll have a new discussion on a topical theme, and as always, the latest news, a cultural section, and music. Tune in for a new episode and write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org, ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.